everyone. This is episode 2, I think, of Bad Apples, Season 3. My name is Klaatu. I'm going to be your host today, as I have been for the past 2 seasons. Today we're going to talk about some KDE tips that I've just happened to stumble across, and we're going to talk about the EFI shell, and but we'll get some listener feedback as well, since I'm always neglecting to kind of review that. So stay tuned. Oh yeah, and I'm supposed to mention that this podcast is a member of the Tech Podcast Network. TechPodcast.com, I think, is the site. It's got a couple of different technical-related podcasts. Perhaps even more, I think, of interest to most of my listeners would be HackerMedia.org. That I'm on their site as well, which makes me proud. If you don't go to HackerMedia.org, you should. It's called HackerMedia.org. It's like an aggregator of a lot of different feeds. So there's just a whole bunch of different technology-related sites on there, or feeds on there. So if you're looking for a new podcast, there might be something here that you've not heard of. The latest one that I found was Chromed Pork dot something. So it's Chromed Pork Podcast. It's a ridiculously technical podcast. Really, really cool. This guy knows a lot about what he's talking about. And in his latest, not his latest, actually, his earliest episodes, the ones that I've started listening to, he was talking about the cell phone network, you know, how it works, how it scales, security issues, just everything you can imagine, he goes over. It's really informative stuff. He takes his time. He doesn't, like, skim over it at all. He talks a lot about it, so it's very, very cool. You should definitely check that out. But HackerMedia.org is a cool site run by, you know, some of the guys out of Binary Revolution, BinRev, the whole digital dog pound kind of thing. So it's got good quality stuff on there. It's also got a really snazzy little icon theme, so you know what aspect of technology each podcast is about. So check it out. You know, recently Pat on the Linux Link Tech Show has kind of had it out for people talking poorly of free software, especially on a series of podcasts that, you know, a lot of technical people are going to be listening to, like high-profile podcasts. You know, when people talk poorly about free software as if though it just isn't any good or whatever, seems kind of silly for them to sit there and talk about how bad free software is when, you know, the fact that they're online is probably being made possible by free software. The fact that they can share files across a Samba network, if they're on a Mac network, is because of free software. You know, so many things are obviously using that free software that it is ridiculous for them to sit there and complain about it as if though, you know, it wasn't any good. And even if they feel that way, you know, blanket statements like that are fairly uneducated. Not that I've never made any blanket statement about operating systems, but even so, you know, you can't just dismiss free software, you know, because, I mean, it's just, it makes you seem really uninformed because you're using it. On any system out there at this point, you're using free software, so you might as well not talk about it as if though it was just no good. To that point, I used... I guess because of that, I am a little bit hypersensitive about things from non-free software companies shipping in a less than perfect state. Okay, so, I mean, I might be a bit of an absolutist here, but if you're going to sit around talking about how rough around the edges free software is or how it doesn't work, then, you know, that raises you to a pretty high standard. And if you're going to be charging people for a service, or you're going to be shipping, you know, proprietary code that apparently is just so good that you can't release it to other people so that they can improve it or look at it or borrow parts of it or whatever, then that code had better be really, really good. So for work, I I was given and have to maintain a so-called .Mac account. And .Mac is the Apple online service to that provides online storage, about 20 gigs, I think. It's, you know, it's a fair amount of storage, an email address. That actually doesn't get much spam. It's pretty nice. And it allows people to sync computers between, you know, other devices and other computers, and to VNC to their computer, things like that. So it's kind of a connectivity kind of add-on service that people subscribe to. I don't subscribe to it because, like I say, it's more of an obligation than anything else for this job. I don't actually use it that much simply because I have services. I have all those things anyway, since I'm on so many different computers and devices, and I don't really use it except when I'm at work, because the work computer is tied into that account. And today when I was out at a cafe this morning with my EEE PC, and I had written some code that I was going to, you know, for work, and I was going to post it to this online storage so that I would have it on my work computer when I got there on Monday morning. And there's a web interface for that online storage, so I decided to try to go there and log in and post the code. To my surprise, I got an error screen that said that I had to be running Firefox 2 or greater for Mac or PC, or Safari 3 or later, I guess, for Mac or PC. And that kind of surprised me, because I thought I was running Firefox 2, and I went to the help menu and about Firefox, and sure enough, it was 2.0 point something. And I thought, well, okay, maybe what they really mean is Firefox 2.5 or later or something like that. So I went home, got on my Fedora system where I'm running Firefox 3.0, tried again, same error message. That struck me as quite odd. So I thought about it a little bit, and I figured first thing I might as well try is the old trick of changing my user agent. All right, so I have already downloaded, of course, the user agent switcher add-on for Firefox. If you haven't downloaded that, it's well worth having. If you go to sites that are run by Microsoft or apparently Apple or you know, other companies that maybe aren't really coding their sites the proper way, you can get that. So I got that, and I had to make a user agent profile for myself, and I will give you the exact settings in case you need to, or in case you've never done this kind of thing before. So you go to User Agent Switcher, go down to Options, go to Options, go to User Agents on the left-hand side of the window that's going to pop up, and you'll see all the different presets that you've got. And I think by default it comes with Internet Explorer 7, Windows Vista, Opera, Windows Vista, and Netscape, Windows Vista. Well, I wanted to go ahead and be identified as Firefox 3, because that is what I'm using anyway, so I might as well, you know, be identified as such. So I went in to the Netscape profile and changed it around a little bit so that the description read Firefox 3.0 and then in parentheses Windows Vista. And that's not really anything except for my own reference. User agent, now that's the important one, should read Mozilla/5.0 space bracket EN close bracket and then Windows NT 6.0 semicolon capital U close parentheses. And then the app name is Netscape. The app version is 5.0. Again, it's bracket EN, close bracket, open parentheses, Windows NT 6.0, semicolon, capital U, close parentheses. Platform is Win32. Okay, so those are the exact settings that I put in for my user agent, and I went back to the Mac.com, or actually it's me.com now. The login screen appeared, and I was in. So it was a little bit surprising and rather disappointing to find that whoever's coding this stuff over at Apple, this, you know, very Web 2.0 interface, is discriminating against what OS you're running. You know, if you're being identified that you're running Linux, apparently that's not going to work. Whereas if you are identified as either Mac OS 10 or Vista of all things, then you're in. You're okay. That just seems kind of bad form to me. Not just because Apple is, you know, supposedly arch enemies with Microsoft, but also just because, I mean, a company running a web service, I mean, any website, you know, I mean, in this day and age, it should be OS agnostic. It shouldn't care about that. If your web browser is capable of running whatever little, you know, fancy JavaScript they're coding or whatever you know, they need the browser to do. That's all it should take. And the only reason I mention this, again, is because there are people out there, like Pat is saying, there are people out there saying, oh, free software, I could never run that. I would never run free software on anything. I don't like people, you know, looking at the code. I don't like just anyone changing code on me, or free software just doesn't work, all this other stuff. Because if you're going to be able, if you're going to go public and say those kinds of really ridiculous remarks, then you'd better be ready. You'd better make sure that your application is, when you launch it, that it's compatible with everything, you know, that it's a proper web app, or that it's a proper application, that you don't have these glaring bugs that you're accusing, you know, free software of having. I mean, this is the kind of rough around the edges thing that people might accuse free software of having problems with, whereas, in fact, you know, this is their own little closed source interface that they, I'm sure, are very proud of now. I mean, it's early on, and they'll probably fix it. Hopefully they'll fix it. I hope they fix it. They've just recently switched from .Mac to me.com. So they've redesigned the whole interface, recoded it and everything. So, I mean, it's very early in this particular web application's life. But if you think about it, Google, using free programming language like Python, is doing, you know, all kinds of Google apps that run fine on Linux, Mac, Windows, probably on Haiku, probably BSD, not really a problem. And then you've got other things coming out that aren't working. For whatever that's worth, if you want to go see the screenshots of my travails, you certainly are able to. It's at thebadapples.info/me-love-vista. And that's me, all lowercase, and love with a capital L, and then capital V for Vista. Me love Vista. thebadapples.info/me-love-vista. That will take you to my little preamble and just three quick screenshots showing you that I'm not crazy, or that I'm not making this up or whatever. It's just bad coding, folks. EFI, Extensible Firmware Interface. What an inappropriate name. But nevertheless, that's what Intel calls their version of, I guess, a BIOS, or a BIOS, whatever. So if you've ever, you know, when you're booting up your computer, you hit, like, either Escape or F2 or whatever, and it gets you into the BIOS of the motherboard that you're running. And you can make different settings, you can do different things in there. What Intel has done, I quite some time ago, I'm pretty sure, is developed something called EFI, and this is an interface that allows you, or developers probably more to the point, to get into the, to have access, to have easy access to the boot ROM chips and things like that. That's, you know, the components on the main logic board or the motherboard of the computer. The idea is it's an alternative to BIOS, and I don't believe that many computers come with EFI on it. I know for sure Macintosh computers do, after PowerPC went away, so just the Intel chip Macs do. So if you're running a MacBook, for instance, I see those everywhere these days. Maybe you're running Ubuntu on the MacBook, or Fedora, or Slackware, whatever. You got one of those, you got EFI running when you first boot. The boot process, by the way, is, you know, really interesting. And so when you're first booting, I mean, that's EFI kind of taking a quick review of what exactly your computer is, or what it has available to it. You know, the fact that you've got a hard drive that your computer can talk to, that your OS can talk to, is because the EFI woke up and said, oh, wow, looks like I've got a hard drive and a CD drive, and I've got two sticks of RAM, and they're, you know, all that stuff. That's all the EFI before the OS really kicks in. Now, if you want a review of the boot process, particularly the Linux boot process, you can listen to one of the series on Hacker Public Radio by another Linux Link Tech Show guy, Dan Washko. He's got like a six-part, it's up to six parts right now, really, really informative shows on what happens when you, you know, hit the power button. Very, very informative. I've listened to most of those episodes twice, and it's still trying to process it all. It's really interesting. But EFI would, of course, be prior to most of what he is talking about in the Linux boot process. EFI, you know, I mean, typically the computer that you get is, it's all been, you know, obviously all the boot ROM stuff is there. It's all the chips have been flashed properly. They've all got the information that they need to have, all the different versions of this little tiny firmware, little software that the chips are running. They're all there. And it's probably not a great idea to just go try to reflash those chips or anything like that. But if you want to, or if you're interested in this kind of thing, or if you're a developer and you want to know how you can maybe reflash a chip to test something out, or talk to EFI, what you would need is an EFI shell. Now this, unfortunately, is something that Intel doesn't exactly share with everyone. Intel, just like every other those proprietary companies out there, seems to really like the code that they've developed. Now, they don't like it enough to release it to every programmer in the world so that the programmers can look at it and maybe come up with cool ideas, new things that it could do. They like it in the way that they can keep it to themselves. They do have some, quote, open APIs that you can download straight from Intel. So if you go to, like, intel.com/something-or-another, it will, you know, you'll eventually find the EFI like APIs. They don't give you a whole lot. I mean, they don't give you a completely a really nice shell or anything like that. Well, you know, and their shell isn't that great anyway. But so here's their website. It's intel.com/technology/EFI. Okay, so you can go there, have a look around, read up on it. They got a little diagram there, and it's showing you, okay, there's hardware, and within on the hardware there's firmware, and between the firmware and that OS loader, there is EFI. So if you want to get in there, that's where you would start. Now, luckily, there is a shell that you can download separate from Intel, and this would be at efi-shell.tianocore.org. This is a little shell licensed under the BSD license, and you can download it for free. What you generally would do is place this shell onto a USB stick. Make sure that the USB stick is of the GUID partition sort. It can't be like an Apple partition map or, you know, whatever MS-DOS uses, or maybe, I think MS-DOS might use GUID, actually. So that's the kind of USB, the partition table that you need to have that USB stick formatted under. Pop this EFI shell on that stick, reboot, doing whatever you do on that computer to get into some kind of boot loader, whether it's holding down a certain key combination. I know on my triple EPC, it's the escape key. On most Macintoshes, what am I talking about? Most, all Macintoshes, it's the option key. And it just kind of depends on the computer. So do what you need to do to get into the boot picker. Or if you don't have a boot picker, you should. If it's an EFI, there should be some kind of boot picker. It wouldn't be like, if you're trying to do this on something with like Phoenix BIOS on it, that's not going to work. You can set your, it might work, I didn't try it, but I mean, you would have to set your boot device as the USB, you know, and then you would reboot. I don't think that's going to work though, but it might. It might work, but then you'd be in an EFI shell without any EFI to look at, so, oh well. So anyway, you boot up off of this little USB stick. It's a tiny little image, the EFI shell. I mean, this is not a large application. And once you're in, now you're in the shell. Now I've used two different shells. One is the official Intel shell, and one is this free BSD-licensed EFI shell. Both are pretty limited in what they do. I mean, you're really at a low level here. You're not, you know, it's not like you're not going to be playing Tetris in here. This is just, which would be cool. I mean, I wish someone would, if you could get Tetris and flash that onto a chip, and that way you'd have an instant bootable machine that would just play Tetris, and it would be instant. You would turn it on, and you'd be playing. There'd be no boot time. That would be kind of neat. But that's probably not going to happen anytime soon. So you are, you're in the EFI shell. It's, the Intel version is very, very, very DOS-like. It's got, very strange commands, you know, to list things. You don't type in ls, you type in dir, which I don't even know what that stands for. To reboot, you type in reset, you know, just weird things like that. So it's not that cool, really. I mean, it's not that fun. The cool factor is the knowledge that you get to talk to chips, you know, like straight to the chips. That's kind of nifty. But in terms of like shell emulation and stuff, it's not that fun. The BSD version, it's honestly pretty similar. It's just the same kind of deal. You are in the shell. You can, if you've downloaded like a new version of firmware from Intel, for instance, then you can flash that on your chip here from the shell, and that would be like whatever updater you've gotten. Usually, it's like EFI utility. Or EFI util, something like that. So you would type in EFI util dash F, I think that is for force, and then the image that you're going to flash. And if you're a developer, you'll probably know a lot more than me as far as what to do within this EFI environment. There is the EFI developer kit available from the free version, as well as the free APIs or the open, quote, open EFIs that Intel offers. It's an interesting environment to be in. If you want to give it a shot, you can certainly, like I say, just download this free version. Remember that all the slashes are backwards instead of a forward slash like normal. You have to do backward slashes, and it's really rudimentary stuff. You know, to change over to a drive, you type in the name of that drive. So, you know, USB 0:: will get you into your USB stick. You can actually then use CD and go into the directory with the new firmware image that you've downloaded. You know, you can edit backslash for editing source code. You can list the devices. Just type in devices. You can look at the device tree. That's device tree backslash. You know, just different things. I mean, there's a whole manual on the site, on the free shell site. So you can look at that and play around with it if you want. Like I say, don't go flashing chips just for fun. That's probably a bad idea. If you just want to look at what the environment is like, go for it. Or if you're a developer, like I say, you'll probably know a lot more about what to do in there once you're in there than I could possibly tell you. So have a good time. And the site again is efi-shell.tinocore.org. So knock yourself out. Okay, so I guess I'm going to go a little bit crazy on the listener email this episode because I, for whatever reason, I always forget to read it, or I answer the person by email and then I don't really think to, you know, include it on the show. But I had some good ones this time, so I think I'm going to go ahead and talk about some of the things that people emailed me about. So one of the emails I got was from a guy named 330, probably not his real name. Apparently he's a closet KDE user. I don't know why he'd be a closet KDE user. I would run it as I do with pride. But he says that he's a closet KDE user and wants to know some some tips on how to really get it going smoothly and nicely. So KDE 4.0, as everyone knows by now, is a little bit rough around the edges. It was not apparently meant for general consumption. It is it's like the public beta, I guess, is what you could call it, kind of off of the developers' table and into your computer if you're one of the brave early adopters. Apparently, I'm a brave early adopter because I have been running it as my primary desktop environment, at least on my main computer, ever since it was released, and I've been enjoying it. But it does have some idiosyncrasies, most of which are, I think, it seems like they're going to probably be all moot points when 4.1 is released, and 4.1 is just around the corner. They came out with their beta 2, 4.1 beta 2, recently. I've not updated to that. I'm just going to wait for the real update, the 4.1. But in the meantime, there are a couple of things that you can do to make your 4.0 desktop a little bit easier to deal with sometimes. First of all, you want to get rid of your desktop icons. I know you like your desktop icons. You want them. I personally don't. Ever since I was getting into Fluxbox, I kind of really got into the idea of kind of having a clean desktop, you know, not having all those icons cluttering up your immediate line of sight. So I'm not crazy about it. So when I say kill your desktop icons, I'm saying it very easily because I don't like desktop icons anyway. But the KDE4 method of implementing desktop icons involves basically making widgets out of the files and then referring those widgets to the actual files. Really kind of clunky. So what you're going to want to do is X all of those widgets out. Well, first move the icons out of the desktop directory in your home folder and put them, you know, wherever they belong. So if it's that song that you just have to hear every day, go ahead and put it in your music directory or wherever you keep your music. You know, it doesn't probably need to be out on your desktop. Documents, you know, put them in your work and your directories, wherever you're filing all your stuff away. So you do that, and then you can X out the little widgets or the plasmoids that KDE 4.0 makes in order to represent that they were there. Strangely enough, if you move the directories, those plasmoids may not automatically go away. They certainly didn't for me. So you have to go out and physically X them out, each one by one. But at least then they're off your desktop. And then what you'll want to do is right-click on the desktop itself, go to Configure Desktop, and where it says Show Icons, just click that off so that it doesn't bother making icons for the desktop anymore. Okay, so the other thing you're going to want to do is, well, there's a couple of things you're going to want to do with the kicker. The kicker seems to be a lot more fragile than it really ought to be in 4.0. It's probably going to be a lot more robust in 4.1, I would think. One of the things that the kicker doesn't seem to like is that little system tray. And the system tray is the place where all your system notifications are, all the applets, basically. So you've got your, you know, whether you're online and what network you're connected to, that little applet, that little icon that displays that, the volume control, pulse audio control, the clipboard, clipper, whether you're plugged in or not plugged in, you know, battery power, stuff like that. In addition to that, you get your SE Linux warnings. So if you're trying to do something and you forgot to SU first, then you'll see SE Linux warnings popping up. And you'll see daily updates or weekly updates whenever you have your computer automatically searching for updates. Those icons will pop up. Instant message icons, IRC icons, you know, all those kinds of little notifications. That's what's going on in your system tray. And the kicker, it just wreaks havoc on it. When the icons go away and come back and move around, they start making, like, fake instances of themselves, or little ghost images of themselves in the kicker. It's really bothersome. So what I did was I right-clicked on that system tray area and said remove from panel. Don't worry, you're going to get it back. Now go up to the right-hand corner of the screen where it says Add Widgets, and add a widget, and in that list of widgets, you'll find, sort of near the end, it's alphabetical, I think, System Tray. Click on that, say Add to Desktop, and it will create a plasmoid or a widget with all those little applets in it. And that will be freely positionable. You can place that anywhere you want on your desktop. You can resize it. You can make it small. Whatever you want to do with it, now you've got complete control over it and the added benefit of it not doing all kinds of weird things to your ticker. Another handy plasmoid to have is the battery status plasmoid. I have that near my clock, not my big analog clock, because I don't have a big analog clock, but my little digital clock in the kicker, which, by the way, you can right-click on your digital clock in the kicker, and you can have it show you the day and the date and the year if you need the year. That's kind of handy as well. And then last but not least, if you're playing around with your desktop configuration and you screw it up beyond repair, what you can do is just be aware that all the config files for your KDE environment are in your home folder in a hidden folder named .kde. So if you go in, if you cd tilde in space tilde slash .kde slash share, there's a folder in there called config, and in that config folder, there's just a whole bunch of text documents with all the properties of what your desktop thinks it should be doing. So if you screwed something up specifically, you might be able to just go in into that configuration, and go to locate the config file that controls that aspect of whatever you've screwed up, and literally just rename it, so that KDE can't find it. Once you log out and log back in, it will regenerate a default config file for that property. Now, if you need to do that to the whole config folder, you can do that, but be aware that your KMail configuration files are in the config folder. So if you say, if you're just going to copy or move config to config dash, backup or old, your KMail configuration is in there. So when you log out and log back in, you start up KMail, guess what? All your accounts will appear to be totally empty. Don't panic. Just go to config-old and copy the KMail config files to your new configuration. So that's where all that stuff is. It's good to know where that stuff is. Now, my co-host for Fedora Reloaded, Skirlet, she and I were messing around with KDE for a while, kind of, just configuring it, and she did a Hacker Public Radio based on our notes. And so there is an episode of Hacker Public Radio on just kind of further configuration and, I guess you would say, pimping your KDE desktop a little bit more. It's not gratuitous. I mean, it really is. Some of them are just helpful usability features, like drop shadows, so that you can actually distinguish one window from another, because the contrast on KDE 4 isn't that great. There's a lot of white and light grays, and you're just like, where's one window? Where's the other window? So adding a drop shadow and stuff like that helps. The downside of that, I have found after living with what we had set up, was that it really does seem to affect the kicker. So if you've got like a really bright desktop background, it will be very noticeable, because the kicker, if you turn on these desktop effects, the kicker seems to, like, chunks of it just seem to disappear, like splotches of color just kind of disappear from the kicker, so that it's semi-transparent at times. It's really, really bizarre. I haven't narrowed it down. I don't know if it's just my computer or everyone's computer. I probably need to ask a couple of people, if theirs is doing the same thing. Although, like I say, it's probably a moot point, because 4.1 is right around the corner. So if you're waiting for KDE 4.1, that's fine. I think you'll like it. It's a really good desktop. I'm certainly enjoying 4.0. immensely, in spite of the problems, that I'm mentioning here. These are things that aren't really that big of a deal, and you can be worked around really easily. Nothing worse, with this than, just installing the default desktop of any environment, or any OS for that matter, and having to configure it, to to be exactly the way that you want it to be. So, you know, you figure configuration is part of life. So those were my KDE 4.0 tips. Okay, so more listener feedback. Spanish Pedro is from Spain, and he emailed me about Vim, because I think me and Jonathan, the guy I interviewed on the last episode, episode 2, were talking about Vim. And Pedro points out that Vim, most systems come, well, number one, he notes that Vim seems to be a pretty universal text editor, which seems to be fairly true. I mean, if you go to pretty much any system, I've found you can get to either Vi or Vim successfully. And for whatever reason, the big alternative, Emacs, is not apparently on every system. Like, it's on a lot of systems, obviously, but it's not on every system. Now, I love Emacs as much as the next guy, but I just, for whatever reason, I kind of fell into Vim. I like where the keys are. It just kind of works for me. Now, Emacs is, you know, really, really flexible. It's really cool. And one of these days, I'm going to set up a computer and have just Emacs on there and just, like, do ridiculous things with Emacs. But not yet. So he points out that Vim has a tutorial. So if you're not familiar with Vim and you haven't fallen in love with it yet, you can type in, go to the terminal and type in Vim tutor, I think is the command, and it will pop up a very nice and comprehensive lesson on how to use Vim. And it goes on for a while. I knew about this, and I did this tutor at one point. Since then, I had picked up at Scale, Southern California Linux Exposition, a cheat sheet on Vim, and it stays by my computer at all times. It's really nice because it just gives you all the different, you know, commands to, you know, search and replace, to go to the beginning of a sentence, the end of the sentence, beginning of the file, end of the file, just everything you could ever want to do in Vim. So that kind of thing is really handy. And obviously, if you just type in Vim keyboard commands in Google, you're going to find that kind of comprehensive list. You could theoretically print that out. I find that if you keep that sort of thing next to your computer while you're working, and then just whenever you realize, man, if I could just go in and find and replace, it'd be a lot easier. Well, you know, resist the urge to, you know, select everything and copy and paste it into, like, Kate or Gedit or Kword or OpenOffice and do it your comfortable way. Just force yourself to research it a little bit, find out how it's done. You know, do that a couple of times, and next thing you know, it's going to be, like, second nature to you. So, yeah, that's what Pedro was talking about, and that's what it made me think about. So that's cool. I got not an email, but I guess it was feedback nevertheless, and I wanted to mention it just to kind of give myself a little bit of support or whatever. I had mentioned on some show that Mandriva 2008.1 had done a really swell job of designing, you know, making sure that their release was compatible out of the box with the EEE PC. And it's always nice to hear feedback from other people, you know, just so you know that you yourself, you know, weren't a fluke or you just got lucky or whatever. But yeah, Dan from the Linux Link Tech Show was seconding the motion once in the IRC while they were doing the show. He mentioned it to me that in fact he'd tried it out and that it was actually running really well for him, and that he was pleased with it on his triple EPC. So if you're getting an EEPC at some point soon, or if you've got one and you're kind of starting to get tired of that terrible Zandros interface, you can certainly try Mandriva 2008.1. It's just the stock release. It's the same thing that everyone else downloads. You can download it, pop it onto a hard drive, boot with the escape key held down, and install straight off of, you know, the ISO image, and it will install onto your Triple E PC, and everything pretty much seems to work just out of the box. One thing that Dan was saying that he was a little bit that he wanted that it did not have was Wicked, WICD, the network manager replacement. I've still not tried this Wicked thing, and I really should. So I'm going to try to download it. He was saying that it was not in the repo of the Mandriva repo. So I'm going to try to download the source, compile it or whatever, and give it a shot just for fun. Just to try it, see how it works, and maybe I'll mention how it performs after like a week or two of using it on the EE PC. But it's good to hear from other people, is what I was saying, because that way you know that, yeah, it actually is not just you, it's other people are having success with, this distro and this piece of hardware. So you can try it out if you want to. This has been the Bad Apples, episode 2 of season 3. Music was by Fat Chance Lesta. And my email address is gort.klaatu@gmail.com. And the website is thebadapples.info. Be sure to also listen to fedorareloaded.com, my podcast with Skirlet on the Fedora distribution.